The basic component parts have been known for centuries. Just how people work still presents significant challenges. For example, it's only in the last decade that the ability of the cochlear to amplify sound has been identified and qualified. Prior to this, testing involved dissection of the ear, which necessarily meant that any in vivo behaviours ceased. Sound travels from the external head and ears or pinna to the ear canals and to the eardrums, providing some modification of the sound to allow determination of direction. Behind the eardrum is a set of bones or levers that match the already minuscule movements of the eardrum to the force required to activate the fluid field structures of the inner ear. That's the behaviour of this inner ear that is the subject of tonight's presentation. Traditional thinking is evolving, but has the inner ear structures able to discriminate frequencies and excite relevant nerves to provide the sensation of hearing to the brain by movement of hair cells immersed in fluid. Amplification is provided by cell structures able to change their dimensions rapidly in response to nerve signals and so provide either positive or negative feedback. Tonight, Rod will present an alternative theory of operation of the inner ear that hopefully will present and provoke some thought and discussion on this interesting area. So, I'm going to introduce Dr. Rod Staples.
Thank you, Jim. Just give me a couple of seconds while I plug myself in here. Normally, I sit in the audience, like most of you, and I listen enthralled to people who've actually stood up here and they're describing the work that they personally have done. And it's wonderful. I'm not able to do that because I'm not a biologist, I'm an engineer. And I am reporting on the work that somebody else has done that I just happen to find absolutely fascinating. And I wouldn't be presenting this material if I didn't think there was something substantive behind it. But it's an awkward situation, and this is where, in the meeting notice, you saw that there was some controversy associated with this. There isn't a lot of peer review in the community about this work. There's a lot of substance in the work itself. It's difficult and dense to read and to work through, but I guess by publicising that the work is available, what I'm doing is putting it out into the audio community for people to look at it, to search more deeply than I'm going to present tonight, and to come back with arguments that, no, that couldn't possibly be right, or yes, I can endorse that. So we'll get a discussion happening in the community about this material. I've had discussions with Graham Huon over the last couple of weeks, who's been adamant that we should present the traditional understanding alongside this material. I do try to do that, but very superficially, because I want to focus on the new stuff that's in Fulton's material. And as I've said, I'm really only scratching the surface with this stuff. At the end of this slide set, there'll be a set of web sites that you can go to. Each of them has about 2,000, 2,500 densely written pages of technical information, some of which is arguments why the current theory can't possibly be right, and an alternative to that, which is substantiated with a whole lot of general engineering or observations or whatever. Now, while I said that a lot of the people who stand up here also talk about their own personal experiences, my observation is that I don't think Jim Fulton actually has either. What he has done is a very, very, very thorough meta-analysis. He's collected papers over a lifetime in this area, formed some opinions, and found the evidence in the papers that hundreds of other people have actually done. I can't find any question at all about the depth of the literature review that underpins this work. It's very, very extensive. And again, I'm only superficially covering it, and Graham sent me a paper over the last week or so that actually confirms one of the points independently that I'll be talking about briefly tonight. So I guess you should be introduced to this person who I'm speaking about tonight. Before I do that, what do we understand about the ear? Well, we understand what the textbooks tell us. For 70 years, the textbooks have been put together by as Jim said, by cutting up cat's ears and camel's ears and whale's ears and whatever else and trying to come to some conclusion about how these things work. poor monkeys have been sort of chopped up to try to find out how they work rather than chop up humans. A lot of the mechanical stuff at the outside, and in the introduction, mention was made of the pinnae, the ossicles, the bones that link the inner ear and outer eardrum, and fluid movement and fluid mechanics inside the ear, the cochlea. We know the cochlea is there. We know the nerves all end there. We know hair cells have a very significant impact on the way hearing works. And if we didn't know all of that, the cochlear implant wouldn't work. And clearly it does. So we know a lot about the mechanics of getting the sound into the cochlea, and we know something at least about getting the sound out of it into the brain. And there's been a fair amount of work done on how the brain actually processes that information as well. And that comes at the problem from different directions as well. But that's a talk for another day. It's the bit in the middle. It's what happens inside the cochlea that most of the textbooks seem to be wrong. And what I'm doing today is trying to highlight where I think the areas are wrong and what the alternate model that Jim proposes, which to me seems to make sense, but you're welcome, please, to challenge the assumptions that come through this presentation. Who is this Jim Fulton? If you look at Wikipedia, he's a fairly elderly gentleman now. He's born in 1935, long before me. He's a neuroscience researcher who publishes most of his research on the internet. In fact, anything you want to know about what he thinks about the ear is pretty much there. And in the 3 or 4 years that I've been following this material, it's been growing almost exponentially. There's about three websites that I'll give you at the end of the presentation. Each of them has about 2,500 densely written pages on them. So enjoy your reading for the next year and a half. Before his retirement, he was part of the military industrial complex, working for Hughes Aerospace in their optical division at the top of the list. Is he well enough educated to be able to provide this information? Well, yeah. He's got a Master of Electrical Engineering, a Bachelor of Electrical Engineering, an MBA, which is probably not relevant here, but he has the research skills through that. He's got a whole lot of patents from his work at Hughes, and he's published most of his work on the internet. And there is the one of the websites. It's the overlying website that gives you access to all of them. He's also given us permission to put these slides, which do have his illustrations on them, on the AES website after this presentation. So if you miss something, or if it's too hard to read, which it probably will be on the screen, by all means go to that website in a few days when Peter gets the copies and puts them up there. They will be there. What's his work experience? It starts with vision and imaging at CBS Laboratories. So he's probably started, like many of us, in the television audio industry. Grumman Aerospace for imaging and satellites. Hughes Aircraft Lab Manager for optics design, so he knows a bit about the optics. Vice President, optics manufacturer, assistant division, microcircuit manufacturer, and then a whole lot of consultants and a whole lot of prototyping since about 1995, when I think he retired. I'm not quite sure, but I think that's about when he retired from full-time work, to work on the consultancy and the other research that he's doing. He tells me that he's got at least another four consultancies going at the moment all over the world. I'll be interested to see the results of that work, but he tells me that'll be another 12 months or so away yet before that's published. If we come back to the ear itself, this is the standard textbook interpretation of how the ear works. We have this thing on the outside, this flap of skin, that has a whole lot of functions. One of those functions is to direct sound and channel it into what is effectively an acoustical horn, which is an acoustical transformer. So you're effectively coupling sound from the outside into the acoustical impedance or mechanical impedance of the eardrum itself. The shape of the pinnae are associated with the sensing front and back, and the fact that we have two spaced ears with focusing of the sound to the front, preference to the front, is very important for survival, for localization, because we're a top predator. And we can relate that back to the same sort of mechanics in animal ears as well. There's no difference. The inner ear we know quite a lot about. That's the diaphragm itself, the actual eardrum, that's quite near the surface. You can poke holes in it, and it can be repaired. I'm not suggesting that you do, but I know that kids often have that problem when they're very young, and it does repair itself. So it's a mechanical surface, it's a tight drum that effectively translates the sound from air pressure variations into mechanical vibrations. The mechanical vibrations, if I can get this little thing to work, this is a nice little toy in PowerPoint 2010. This area here is an area called the ossicles. It's the smallest bones in the human body. There are three of them, and they do give a slight mechanical advantage. I'm told the mechanical advantage is about three. It's not very big at all. So in terms of gain, it's not there to provide much gain in terms of coupling the sound into the inner ear. But what it is there is a compressor, so that if you get presented with very large sounds, the muscles around those ossicles and supporting those ossicles tighten and prevent the sound from getting through into the inner ear, and then therefore try to prevent some of the damage that's likely to occur otherwise. We know a lot about how they work, why they work. I'm not sure that they can actually be replaced, but they're a mechanical system. We can work out the levers and so forth and work out the mechanical advantage from there. From there, the sound goes to an oval window on the surface of the cochlea. Now, the cochlea itself is a snail shell-shaped void in the bone, in the mastoid part of the ear, just in here. And that is where all the hearing transduction from sound pressure or mechanical variation into neural impulses happens. It's in the cochlea itself. And short of actually opening it up and destroying its function, there's very little way of actually getting in there and measuring it. And in terms of electronics, the voltages are down near the microvolt or picovolt levels, and you're dealing with systems where that if you try to put a probe in there, you're actually going to destroy cells or disturb the cells or the signals that you're trying to measure. So actually measuring these things has been problematic for many, many years. There aren't a lot of measurements in the literature that are concrete or supportive of any of these things. And this is one of the problems, I think, with Fulton's work that he's trying to now work on with the current consultancies, in that there's a whole lot of hypothesis here, but there's not a lot of empirical evidence to support it. Now, one of the papers that Graham Huon sent me in the last couple of weeks, they were wrong in some of the hypotheses that they had about how these mechanisms worked, but the evidence they provided was in fact support for one of the points that I'm going to make later on. So the evidence is coming out, it's growing. Sometimes you've got to take Fulton's work on faith, but then again we had to take Galileo's work on faith as well, and we had to take Einstein's work on faith until they could actually fly atomic clocks around the world. It's that sort of level of scientific understanding at the moment. It's not rock solid, but it's something that we can start with. The cochlea itself does two things. It turns mechanical variations into electrical or chemical signals, and it depends on which model you're talking about, whether they are mechanical or chemical signals. The current thinking is that there's a filter in there that somehow mechanically wiggles the hair cells and amplifies the signal. And that was one of the points made in the introduction. That is very standard current thinking technology in the textbooks. It also happens to be wrong, which is the point that I'm going to make later. So that's really what I'm talking about. Why is that wrong, and what is the alternative? Again, here is the traditional model. We have this long wound out cochlea as a straight element, and by the way, it won't work if it's wound out straight, and I'll show you why later. Essentially, the model says you've got two windows there. There's the oval window at the top that's connected to the ossicles, and you've got the round window at the bottom that causes a bulging and refraction so that you have somewhere for the pressure wave to go when it's injected into the fluid. The basilar membrane is this membrane down the centre of the cochlea that is caused to vibrate by the slow travelling wave that's moving through the fluid, the endolymph or the perilymph that's got fluid in there, and you get this vibration mysteriously on the basilar membrane, And because the nerve cells, the hair cells, which you can dissect the ear and find and see and photograph, are in contact with the basilar membrane, the movement of the basilar membrane is said to cause the mechanical transduction, electrical transduction into the nerve cells. Problem is, no one's actually found a mechanism theoretically that describes this process. Everybody said, well, it must be that way because we can't think of any other way. So lots of people have said this is the way, and for 70 years this has flowed through the textbook thinking. The other thing that comes out of this is that the vibration of the basilar membrane itself doesn't explain for the selectivity that you get when you get the signals actually to the nerve cells itself, because this vibration at best is going to have a fairly low Q quality factor. That means it's going to be wideband compared with the bandwidth of the signals that you're feeding in. Now, to overcome the fact that it is observed to be much sharper than can be achieved by the basilar membrane alone, people have surmised that there must be some sort of feedback mechanism or amplification mechanism operating that enhances the selectivity of those hair cells in some way. And the process has hypothesised that there's a mechanical coupling in there that causes the hair cells to shrink or move up and down, and that is a feedback mechanism, and therefore that sharpens the cue of the selectivity. It's still about 1,000 times broader than is observed in practice. So again, there's no evidence to support that hypothesis. It's just a hypothesis that's thrown out there. It's still a good hypothesis because it's good enough to allow the cochlear implant to work. Because what the cochlear implant does is it puts a little wire in around where the basilar membrane is somewhere, very close to it, presumably in the same area that the hair cells are in the cochlea. If you put a fast Fourier transform in the electronics outside that hair cell and feed those to selectively to terminals around that and feed an electrical signal out of that implant at microvolt levels, then it will represent the same sort of frequency selectivity that you can get out of the hair cells themselves. Rather coarser, and therefore you won't get the high fidelity, but you can actually cover all of the filters, and that you can't actually determine much difference from normal hearing is evidenced by the fact that you can use that same sort of frequency selectivity in Dolby systems and those sorts of filters that actually use broadband filters over broad areas, and that they still sound hi-fi when you listen to it as a whole. Masking effects use these broadband things as well. So you can get quite good fidelity from 25 or 30 of these frequency selective filters, and the electrical coupling out of the cochlea into the cells that connect to the neural cells is quite reasonable. And it obviously works, because otherwise cochlea wouldn't be in business. There's some problems with this traditional though. When you start looking at the dispersion characteristics of a wave in fluid, it's three-dimensional. Also, if you look at the idea that there is a discontinuity somewhere up where the energy is taken out by the vibrating membrane, there's no such discontinuity ever found or explained. No one can actually give you a mathematical model to describe that process. The transverse pressure wave applied differentially along the length of the basilar membrane as a function of frequency cannot be satisfactorily modelled or explained. The vibration of the membrane alone is said to use to excite the sensory neurons. We'll see in a minute that this cannot be so. It physically is impossible. The vibration, the normal theory says, is caused by a broadband signal in this theory, yet the response is said to be resonant phenomena at particular distances along the membrane. How can it be resonant and broadband at the same time? You know, there's a paradox in there somewhere. Okay, we have a look at the diagram of the ear itself closer. Here we're taking a cross-section through the cochlea, and the circle, the red circle in the middle, shows the sharp pointy end, the bits. I apologise for the size of the diagram and the clarity here. I usually expect the projectors to be a bit sharper than this. But the slides, it is better on the slides, and you can have a look at them when you download them. this shows the basilar membrane itself, which is at the bottom along there, firmly fixed to the bone at one end, firmly fixed to the bone at the other end. In other words, it's a rigid beam. Oh, then we have this little trapezoidal structure in here, which is also a bony structure, called the organ of Corti. It's a trapezoidal box that runs the entire length of the basilar membrane. Now, any of you who've done Civil Engineering 101, which I did in my diploma, will recognise the structure of a box bridge. It's got a flat platform on top, and it's got this trapezoidal box underneath it that gives us its rigidity and strength along the length of it. Mechanically, it's not designed to vibrate. Yes, it will have some slow vibrations that vary in accordance with the wind. You know, if you get a cyclone on a box bridge, it will tend to twist and warp, and it's designed to have that amount of flexibility. But it certainly doesn't have the flexibility that would account for the hearing mechanism. So the first point that is in question here is the basilar membrane in any way directly involved with hearing selectivity or sensitivity? The short answer is yes, but not the way people think. It is a solid, rigid platform on which the sensors actually are mounted. Okay? It provides a very solid, rigid base that is braced in three dimensions. We have another membrane that's internal in that as well. And that's that membrane there, which is not bony, it's fibrous, and it's called the tectorial membrane. And it's sort of like a bridge over the top of the hair cells. Again, this doesn't vibrate, but again, it is rigid, and it's a solid platform for another feature that is not shown in most of the medical textbooks. But if you actually get in underneath that and dissect a cow's ear that's big enough to see it, you find that the undersurface of the tectorial membrane is actually coated in a gel-like substance. It's a set of cells that are oriented in much the same way that in electronics the liquid crystals are formed. The cells are oriented in a particular direction and they have a jelly-like sort of substance associated with them. Now, you can actually physically see it if you dissect the ear. And nobody's been able to explain it. Hey, it's just another bit of the goo that's floating around inside the ear that nobody really takes too much notice of. Well, if the basilar membrane and the organ of Corti near it are rigid structures, can we get anything out of this motion of the fluids? Well, when we start looking at the propagation velocity, and this is something that Graham could probably test because he's got expertise in this area, the propagation velocity of the sound in the fluid medium itself is vastly different from the observed duration between the onset of sound and the perception of sound, which happens to be in the 6 to 10 millisecond sort of range. There's no evidence, when you actually look at the mechanics of how this is translated in the vibration of the basilar membrane or the tectorial membrane, or indeed the motion of sound in the fluids, that gives support to the resonance amplifiers that are supposed to raise the Q. So there's another one of those conventional wisdom models that seems to be shot down unless someone can come up with some really hard evidence that these things exist. And that's the problem. Nobody's come up with evidence, but they do exist. If we look at it a bit closer, we see that the tectorial membrane is the top of that circle. It's the fibrous layer. And underneath that, it has a gel surface that has two components with it. Up the left-hand end, there's a sort of a thick bit, and then there's a thin bit that trails out towards the end of the tectorial membrane. In contact with the thick bit are the inner hair cells, and there's one row of those. And in contact with the outer flat bit, there's the outer hair cells. And that's the distinction that the traditional literature makes. You can see in this closer schematic of that area just how rigid that bony structure, the organ of Corti, is. The next question is, why do you have these holes and fluids and stuff in there? And the answer to that actually comes from Fulton's work on the eye. The fluids in the eye don't have much of an optical effect. The gel that comes out when you take a sheep's eye and squeeze it is actually there. It's benign as far as the optical stuff is concerned, but it provides the nutrition for all of these cells that otherwise don't have a blood supply. So the fluids in the cochlea itself are about providing nutrition and providing the electrical potentials to make these electrical activators that we're going to talk about in a minute actually function. Without them, the fluids, the cells don't work as they're supposed to. This gel substance is called Henson's stripe, which is the thick bit, and then there's a flat layer towards the outer edge of the tectorial membrane. If you think of the fluid in the traditional model as being a Newtonian wave in a fluid, it spreads out as it goes in and it slows down, and you know, normal wave mechanics take over and its energy is reduced to a quarter every half, doubling of the wavelength and that sort of thing. Inverse square law. So there's a whole lot of problems with getting a sound from the oval window deep into the cochlea, which you remember is a snail's-like shell. It's getting smaller and smaller as we go in, with an ever-expanding wave as we go in as well. So what's happening is the energy is not being saved and conserved. It's being spread out and dispersed, if that is the mechanism that's working. If we could say that the gel-like substance is liquid crystal-like, then that can be structured in such a way that the density difference between that gel-like substance and the fluids that surround it is sufficient to make that gel-like surface, Henson's stripe, behave like a waveguide. Okay? Optical fibre waveguide, optical fibre technology, total internal reflection, if you've got different density in the outer skin to the inner surface. Who came up with the mathematics of that? A guy called Mark Tilley from Bell Labs, working with optical waveguides, optical filters, and optical spectrum analyzers. I'll mention him again later. Now, the theory that Fulton is suggesting is that this Henson stripe is behaving exactly like an optical waveguide, but for the audio sound. Okay? Which means that it has characteristics of a waveguide. It is constraining the sound into a single mode of vibration, and it can be shaped and travel around this cochlear shape, the snail cell shape. How does the sound get in there? Well, it's actually surface acoustic waves. It had to take an engineer to think of this, an engineer who's working with solid-state devices, to think of this. But it's actually putting monomodal surface acoustic waves in one of two ways into this gel-like substance. Henson's stripe itself is providing a channel to take the broadband signal right into the cochlea itself. Because it's curved, we're going to see that in a minute, there will come a point where the frequency exceeds the critical angle and the frequency will escape from the waveguide. At which point it flows out over as a surface acoustic wave again over the surface of the flat bit on the outer side of the tectorial membrane, and there it comes in contact with the outer hair cells. In other words, it becomes a dispersive filter in the same way as an optical waveguide can be used to become an optical spectrum analyzer. And the hairs actually physically touch this gel, so they pick up the motion of the surface. That's how the signal is coupled into the hair cells. The sound wave has to be launched to get in there, so there has to be a mechanism for a launcher to turn the transverse pressure wave from the oval window into this monomode wave in Henson's stripe. Well, this is a sort of a mechanical model. Jim did say that I should point out that it's unwound and therefore it won't work as a dispersive filter in this mode. But it shows the relationship of the inner hair cells to the Henson stripe itself, and the outer hair cells are the frequencies that are shipped out at the various stages along the filter. One thing that is fairly obvious, if this model is correct, is that the signals that reach the inner hair cells is an analog signal. Well, that's fair enough. Most of human senses are analog, and we're sensing an analog world, so why wouldn't they be? However, after a bit of signal processing in the analog domain, the signals are turned into a form of pulse signal at the ganglion cells, which is the signal that is eventually fed onto the audio nerve, or the optic nerve in the case of vision. At that time, they're not frequency dependent or frequency modulated, they're pulse waves that are generated if an amplitude of certain size is exceeded, and they're density modulated. So the bigger the sound is, the more of these pulse ganglion cells are generating signal, and therefore more of the fibres in the audio nerve are actually excited. If it's unwound in a straight line, of course, it won't work as a dispersive filter. When we start looking at the propagation velocity of sound in this gel-like substance, we find that the delay are caused by waiting for that period of transmission along the line reasonably corresponds with the observed delay after the onset of a sound. And it means that the delay in sensing a sound is going to be around 6 to 10 milliseconds, which is consistent with traditional understanding and personal experience. Okay, the two types of surface acoustic wave. One just bounces along the surface, where you have discontinuous densities, different density material. The other one bounces along the inside surface, fed from the opposite side, and that's where the launcher comes into play. The top model, model A, is the model of excitation that works on that broader strip covering the outer hair cells. The model B is the one that works associated with the launcher, getting the sound into the Henson stripe in the first place. So now we have a model for the cochlea itself. It is curved like a snail's shell. That's why the name of the cochlea. It is, in fact, 2.5 terms of a helical logarithmic spiral. I'm going to give you the equation in a minute and show you that this can be mathematically modelled and there's some substance to it. The tail of the logarithmic helix consists of a launcher that is quite close to the oval window in the vestibule of the labyrinth, which is just sort of the fluid-filled cell just inside the oval window where the cochlea itself starts. And it's a wideband acoustic launcher. So the signal that is fed down Henson's stripe is a broadband signal. But if you start off with a broadband signal and you take bits off it, it becomes narrower and narrower and narrower as you move further into the cochlea. Therefore, the highest frequencies are going to be sensed near the beginning of the cochlea, and the largest amplitudes, by the way. And as you move further into the cochlea, the bandwidth is going to be narrowed considerably until you get to the lowest possible frequencies that you can hear right at the end, 2.5 turns into the cochlea. This is looking at the gel-like substance as a two-dimensional model. We're looking down on the top or up from underneath. We have the launcher, the transducer, at one end of the waveguide, Henson's stripe, that's the thick bit, and that has the inner hair cells in contact with it, and their function is to actually take the broadband signal and listen to the loudness of the broadband signal as it moves increasingly filtered into the cochlea. The curvature is important because it is that gives rise to the critical angle and therefore the escape of the sound at a particular frequency. So once the frequency reaches a particular amplitude, high frequencies near the beginning, a very small curve will allow that signal to escape and then feed into the outer hair cells, which are in three broad rows out from the cochlea. This arrangement gives, again I'll use the word, a dispersive filter, not a resonant filter. Okay, can we put a mathematical model behind this? The model that actually applies to the shape of the cochlea, and this is an average over a large number of papers and a large number of dissections, it's called a Hankel function, which is essentially two Bessel functions orthogonally arranged. So it's a three-dimensional functional that gives you your spiral in three dimensions. Unfortunately, the ear doesn't exactly follow that Hankel function model. There has to be a modification deep in the cochlea to improve the fit. There's the formula. I don't understand it either. And there's the fit to the average cochlear dimension. And the three lines are different. The light dotted line is the Hankel function. The modified Hankel function is the heavy dotted line that you can see there. There's the Hankel function. There's the heavy dotted function. And the solid line is the helix, and there's a cross there underneath my pointer that actually is the centre of the helix. So there is a mathematical model that closely approximates what is seen in vivo in life. Now we come to the dispersive filter process, and this is an application of Snell's law. When you reach a certain frequency in association with the difference between the density of the internal part of the transmission line and the outer part, the waveguide, then the sound will escape the bounds of the boundary and try to go somewhere else. It doesn't go orthogonal at that point, but it goes out at some angle off the point. And near the beginning of the curve, we've got the top of the frequency range, 1600 kilohertz, 800 a bit further in, 4000 a bit further in, 2000 a bit further in, so it goes right down about 60 hertz near the tail. Now, this, if you put the numbers into that formula, the magic formula that I gave before, actually comes up with solutions that are fairly close to those positions. So we have a mathematical model that explains the frequency selectivity of the cochlea itself. Now, this is one of those nice textbooks and teacherly things. We've got to try to present a picture that says this is how it's working. There are two parts to this transducer. One is Henson's stripe itself. This is the audio waveguide that is presenting a broadband signal that gets narrower and narrower and narrower as the further you move into it, because you're throwing bits of the high frequency away as you move into the cochlea. And this shows a fairly conventional low-Q circuit, the sort of thing you'd see in an RF textbook, and the sort of thing that you can generate with a mechanical resonance or a resonant circuit. Unfortunately, though, this particular graphical model is about 1,000 times too broad. So if you can imagine the broadband signal, one that's feeding along Henson's stripe, as having a brick wall, almost sort of, the energy's there and the next minute it's not, and it moves a bit further and there's less of the high frequency energy there because it's all been dissipated out into the other stripes. And then you think of these 3,000 little rows of hair cells individually dividing up the frequency range in very narrow Q circuit, high Q circuits. Then you get some idea about the sensitivity and resolution of this dispersive filter. And that's the key point about Fulton's model of how the cochlea works. It is not a resonance effect. It is not because the basilar membrane vibrates. It has nothing to do with fluid in the perilymph. It is about the dispersive filter on Henson's stripe, which has been overlooked by most of the dissectors for the last 70 years. And here he's come up with a model that he can substantiate with mathematics, and if you could implement it on silicon, it would actually work. And surprise, surprise, that's the model that they use for spectrum analyzers and optical waveguides. So he's bringing engineering experience into understanding the biological system. And only an engineer could do it. With this Marcatilli filter, measured slopes are as high as 1,000 dB per decade, which is a bit higher than you can get with any sort of resonance. So what are the functions of the inner and outer hair cells? Well, the inner hair cells are in contact with a broadband signal, an increasingly narrow one as it moves into the cells, but it is a broadband signal. Therefore, it's associated with general loudness of the signal, and there is a frequency component because it's getting narrower and narrower as it moves into the cochlea. But the importance there is a general broadband loudness signal that is fed into the processing amplifiers that happen later. The outer hair cells are the dispersive filter. They're the spectrum analyzer. They're the narrow band channels that are sampling the signal at these very narrowly defined frequencies. And you're seeing hair cells there at the angstrom level in rows of about five in a chevron sort of shape, which happens to be the most efficient shape for capturing the sound and causing the hair cells to vibrate. Here's another mechanical model. This one shows the tectorial membrane as a support for the actual transducer. It's the Henson stripe is the circles. If I can get my pointer to work again. Henson stripe is there. The flat bit of the gel surface is this surface acoustic wave that has reached the critical angle and is now launched out towards the end of the tectorial membrane. The basilar membrane is down here, and it's the substrate on which all of these hair cells are mounted, and the arch of Corti is in fact supporting the tops of the hair cells so that they stay in place. It's a rigid support structure. The thing that moves is the hair cell itself, and that is caused to move by the energy in the surface acoustic wave, either in Henson's stripe or a different type of surface wave on the outer areas. Another model. We can now start to put mechanical constraints on it and develop differential equations that describe the motion. And surprise, surprise, Fulton goes right deep through some of this stuff, and they seem to explain the observed behaviour rather well. Now to the next controversial bit. This is how do you get the energy out of the mechanical vibration of the hair cells. Fulton says that it's a piezoelectric effect. Well, it isn't, but it's like a piezoelectric effect. When you delve deeper into the operation of the neuron, the fact that you put stress on the neuron, the actual hair cell itself, creates differences in potentials across the cell, which free up electrons from the molecules that make up the cell. And they're complex biological molecules. We're a carbon life form, so they are complex. But what happens is you get freed electrons, and they move around the cell. Don't go anywhere else. Fulton sort of argues that they, because the actual barriers, the membranes themselves, are only one or two atoms thick, angstrom-level membranes, that electrons can pass across them. He might be right. I can't say either way, but I suspect not. I suspect the electrons flow in the cells because they remain essentially electrically neutral. But if you get electrons passing across a membrane or dielectric surface, and you have another membrane the other side of the surface with electrically conductive material, then you have a capacitor, and you have capacitive coupling from the hair cells into whatever follows. And when I tried to model the direct coupled approach that Fulton originally started with, the amplifiers didn't work. When I put a capacitor in there, suddenly they all worked. So my suspicion is, and I think he's coming around to this point of view, is that the signal is actually capacitively coupled out of the cuticular plate into an amplifier of some sort. And that's the next Fulton model and where he's got his patents. What Fulton says is that the biology is such, the biochemistry is such, that you have two regions separated by a different region and barriers in between. They are angstrom level barriers, and he goes to some length in the theory of the neuron to describe how they can have electrical characteristics. I'm not going to go into the detail of it. I'm not sure I understand it myself. And if you want to, there's 2,500 pages that do exactly that on the website. But what he's theorising is that at certain parts of the cell, not the whole cell, but parts of the cell, behave like a transistor behaves in the real world that we know about in electronics. Now, he's given this biological transistor a name, and it's patented. It's called an activa. So where you see activa in his writing, it's his word, but essentially what he's saying is that's a biological transistor. Okay? He's determined that this is a PNP transistor. Okay, I'm not going to argue with him. And there are two types. One is the argument that it can happen inside a cell itself, and the other one is that it can happen between two cells. So you can get coupling from one cell to another through this transistor-type mechanism. The neurologists will be more familiar with the dendrite axon-type model for the neural cells. what he's saying is that the junction of two cells or three cells are the terminals that you would have this transistor operating in. So he's come up with a schematic diagram that represents a transistor with a couple of resistors connected to it. And the resistors are easy to hypothesise. It's just the resistivity of the material that the cell is constructed from. What's missing from that, and indeed it's missing from any electrical schematics, is the bias voltages. Therein lies the problem, because we can hypothesise about those as we understand electronic circuits, but here we're dealing in a biological system. So the voltages are distributed throughout various densities of the liquids that make up the cell itself and surround the cells. So we have essentially a liquid battery type construction. Think of it like a lead acid battery. You know, you've got electrolytes in there and you've got terminals in there, and they're creating this flow of electricity, potential difference across a long resistor. And you'll see that sort of modelling come up a bit later. So here's one of those cells that shows that it's rather more complicated than appears just as saying a cell and we've got a whole lot of bits of DNA floating around inside it. It's actually got a mechanical structure. Yes, it's got a nucleus. Yes, the nucleus has DNA in it. But the outside stuff that doesn't have the DNA in it is just as interesting. There's a bit that gets the energy from the fluids that the cell floats in. That's there. There's a bit that handles the waste products and the conversion of the energy into something that the cell can use. Well, you know, cars have got petrol and they've got exhaust systems, so that's reasonable. It's a mechanical system so far. And then we have these things that are circled in red that are the activers. And these are only half an activer, these other things here, and they're behaving like capacitive coupling to the outside world for various reasons. And there's a great amount of detail about what their functions are that A, I don't understand properly, and B, if you want to understand it, there's 2,500 pages to read. So in that one cell, there are effectively three activers. Well, one of them's between that cell and the coupling cell it's connecting to. All right, so we've got activers that can be modelled out of three dendrite cells, or between any two dendrite cells, or even within a dendrite cell for coupling inside that. He's arguing that there are three types of activa, one that has a low impedance bias, and one has a high impedance bias that has a different function, and if you've got capacitors at either end, then it behaves like a relaxation oscillator, and that's the pulse oscillator that eventually becomes a ganglion cell, and that produces the pulses that you sense on the audio nerve and the optic nerve that go into the brain and do all the processing. That's the stuff you can easily measure with a MRI or PET scan type technology. Well, he goes a bit further and says, well, okay, we have a structure here. We've got a hair cell that converts Henson's stripe energy and the stuff in the liquid crystal gel into an electrical signal. Okay? That then takes that electrical signal and couples it into an amplifier, but it's a single transistor, a single activa, called the adaptation amplifier. Now, here's where I get a little bit hairy. I could model the amplifier itself. Fulton says that part of the adaptivity of your hearing mechanism comes about because of the way this amplifier actually works. He suggests that the gain is not just dependent on the bias conditions, but also dependent on the breakdown between the effective collector and base. And there is a form of avalanche breakdown that changes the gain of the amplifier dynamically, depending on the signal that's fed to it. Now, I can't model it, but I can't dispute it either, because we're dealing with biological systems, and if you take a battery and then run it flat, it goes flat, and then you recharge it, and it comes good again and does the same job again, like a capacitor. So there's no reason why you can't have a cell sitting there charged, waiting for sound to come in. If it's big, it just runs the energy down and doesn't amplify as much. The bias changes. And then when the energy goes away, the cell's got time to build up the energy again and the gain comes up again, which would explain the adaptivity of the gain changes when you're presented with loud sounds. And it would also explain how you can have such a large gain swing from standing in front of a jet engine, which will deafen you, to hearing a butterfly land on your ear, which you can do if you try it, or a mosquito. And they're sort of 120 dB apart. How do you explain that adaptivity? Well, if Fulton is right, the adaptivity happens in this first amplifier because the biasing changes because of the amount of energy that's sucked out of the bias circuits by trying to pass the loud signal on. The next part of the stage is the smaller cell underneath it called the distribution amplifier. And the function of the distribution amplifier is to take the output from that one hair cell and to spread it out into a neural network. And this is where we get into the computing world of neural nets. And it gets really interesting. So, okay, we have another electrical schematic that's coming out of this. We have the electrical transducer that is effectively the hair cell in contact with the gel surface, the transmission line, feeding into a series of amplifiers that are biased by the fluids around them, both in the cell and in the outside supporting fluid, which if you rearrange it slightly, it sort of looks a bit like a differential amplifier, except it isn't. If Ed Cherry were standing up here at the moment, he'd say, well, it looks like a differential amplifier, but it isn't because the output's on the other side. In fact, what it is a high impedance common collector amplifier followed by a low impedance input common base amplifier, which any of you who've worked with video amplifiers will recognise as a high input impedance broadband video amplifier. It works. Surprise, surprise. Now, here's where some of the voltages come from. He's worked out in the text, and I refer you to his text to find out what each of those voltages is, where each of those voltages is derived from the chemicals in the ear around that particular cell. And this is part of the electrochemistry of the neuron, which is his patented area, and it's the stuff that he's written the most of his work around. The suggested voltage are estimated, not measured directly, because no one yet has actually been able to measure them with the sort of fidelity that you need. They're poking around inside live ears, but they're not actually getting the sort of resolution you need to do it. And by poking around, you're actually disturbing the voltages. So, okay, if we take this another step further, we have a more complicated neural circuit that goes from the hair cell at the left-hand end to the adaptation amplifier and the distribution amplifier into a set of impedances and the stage 3 amplifier that has a different function again. And you'll see that that stage 3 amplifier, which if I can bring up my pointer, that's that one there, it has a capacitor between a collector and base. It probably also has capacitors between a collector and emitter and base, the other capacitors around a transistor. It's at this point in the circuit that frequency limitations are brought into the individual channels. And all of the channels, whether they deal with high-frequency energy or low-frequency energy at their source, because the signal's fed to them in narrow band, they don't have to be. They are broadband, but the broadband is only 600 hertz. And the paper that you gave me actually provided evidence for that happening in the way the signals were being sampled. Okay? So each of these channels, and there are 3, 4,000, 5,000 of them, each sensing a separate output from Henson's stripe and the tectoral membrane, it's a very narrow band channel, but it's band limited, so there's either a signal there or there isn't, that sort of thing, and there's an amplitude associated with that as well. Now, you have three amplifiers, and they have actually quite large gain, given that this adaptive mechanism may happen in the first one, and I can't say either way which, I'm not convinced by the literature, but Fulton is. If that first adaptation amplifier works as advertised, then that is effectively the compressor front end on top of a high-gain amplifier that is narrow-band but sensing a signal that represents an output from a broadband source. Okay? It's either there or it's not there. It's doing the frequency separation, the spectrum analysis, if you like. I said earlier that one of the characteristics of the scientific method is that you come up with a hypothesis and then you try to prove it by flying clocks around the world or whatever it is that you do to prove the problem. When I first looked at this, I didn't believe it. I said, this just can't be so. How can this amplifier do what it's doing? I've been brought up on Cherry and all those amplifier circuits. So what I did is I set about trying to build one in PSPICE, the student edition of PSPICE. It's not very flash, but it actually works. And I used a 2N222 transistor, 2222, which is a high-speed switching transistor, and it happens to be in the student version of PSPICE. It's there, and it happens to be NPN. So I just turned everything upside down. It's something that I'm familiar with. But the model that I came up with replicated that circuit topology, except that I played around with the bias voltages to make it work in the real electronic world, not in the biological world. So I say this, and this is a quote from one of my psychology books, the model is not the territory. The map isn't the hill that you're going to run up. It's a picture of it. It's a representation of it. This is a model that says, if this circuit has legs, then we should be able to build a real-world circuit that does sort of the same thing and find out whether it works or not. So here's my contribution. First of all, there's some limitations. The model is based on silicon. Therefore, it has large millivolt-type voltages. Obviously, it can't work inside the ear or work like inside the ear. The biological version has angstrom width barriers. It's very small microvolt, picovolt type supply voltages and signal voltages you're dealing with. The biasing uses external bias, not electrostenolytic bias. Now, the word electrostenolytic I can only find in Fulton's work on the web. I did do a search over the weekend. It comes up occasionally in a couple of other papers, including one on Wikipedia, so it must be right. But essentially, most of the sources point back to the same source. So it's his word, I think, for the biological voltages that happen across layers, thick layers of ionic chemicals that happen inside a cell. For convenience, because I had them in the model, I used NPN transistors instead of PNP activators. Because of silicon devices, I had to use volts instead of microvolts or millivolts or picovolts. And the model doesn't include the limitation of the 600 hertz limitation that you find in actual cells. Now, you can't read that up there. It's a mess. You can read it a little bit better if you blow it up on the screen, and for that reason I'm going to put it up on the web so that you can look at this itself. And it shows the adaptation amplifier is actually there's two of them here, and that is a single stage amplifier with appropriate biasing and resistors around it. It's a current source feeding at the bottom. It feeds into a distribution amplifier, which is the other half of the differential pair with the output taken from the collector or from the collector of that. Then I've fed the distribution amplifier into a summing amplifier that mixes the signals together. And then I've used PSPICE to simulate this with two separate frequencies from the two adaptation amplifiers. So therefore I'm saying you can take two cells and you can add the results together to get an output. And the distribution amplifier is like the giving you the loading advantage on an output of a TTL gate. You know, you can plug one gate in and it doesn't load much because it's got this fan out. That's what the distribution amplifiers are effectively doing. The summing amplifier I've modelled is a low impedance input. It's a classical summing junction, virtual earth. But differential amplifiers, you know, you've got two terminals, input terminals on an amplifier. You could equally sum them at the input of that amplifier, and then you've got sum of difference amplifiers. And that, in fact, is what happens at that third layer of the neural system. So how does it work? Well, each of the amplifiers themselves has fairly substantial gain, and they are completely independent of each other until you put them into the summing amplifier, where you get the sum of the two of them. And if I put enough of the right amplitudes in there, I could generate a square wave or a sine wave doing the Fourier trick. Unfortunately, you can only put 10 active devices into the student edition of PSPICE. Bandwidth of that amplifier. The amplifier itself is sort of down about 3 dB at 10 megahertz. It goes out to about 1 meg, which isn't too bad for an audio amplifier. And remember, in the Activa, it's actually band limited to 600 hertz, so this is irrelevant. But it means that the amplifier works rather well. The one experiment that I have done, but I've figured out that I did it wrong, was to figure out the distortion. The lowest distortion I could get out of these amplifiers, even in Cascade, was about 1%. And what I figured out is that that was the sampling rate I was using on the wave, the output wave. And you can get an order of magnitude better than that just by increasing the number of samples you take over the waveform. That's the experiment I haven't done with this particular model. But even with that, with no feedback at all, apart from the internal feedback in the amplifier, it's giving at least 1% over the entire frequency range. So we're talking here about a very good amplifier that doesn't need feedback to give you video bandwidths. So what I'm saying here is that the topology works. If you can actually prove that the Activa is doing all of this stuff, then the topology actually works. Okay, so it's a viable technology. The model does need to be refined if we're going to actually model the actual devices. And that needs the, $1,500, $2,000 version of the full version of PSPICE, and even that is strictly limited and doesn't replicate the avalanche effect. Yes, I've tried, but it doesn't work. So we need to have a better modelling system, or we have to have biological analogues to be able to actually get down to look at some of the finer detail in this. But having a theory is the first step along that path. And if we've got a theory that sort of works at the grand level, then going deeper into that is going to give us finer detail and resolution. That's the bit that hasn't been done yet, and that's where the work is currently going on. And that is where the exciting breakthroughs are likely to happen, because the ultimate long shot of all of this is to get the cochlear implant down so that it's a biological thing that you can just plug into the ear and the body will actually take care of supplying voltages to it, signals to it. You like that? It's heading in that direction. Probably about 100 years from getting there, but that's the direction that this work is actually pointing to. The model needs it to be refined to account for the individual electrostenolytic bias in the cells. The work on the neuron goes part of the way towards doing that. It's much more detailed than I've presented here. But there is evidence to say that this is right. It's just not detailed enough yet to be definitive. Fulton claims that the actual micro and millivolt voltages in the cell have been difficult for biologists to measure in the past. That's on page 214 of his book. And in his correspondence while I was getting him to OK the use of his diagrams, he suggested that this might have been because biologists have a habit of setting their Earth reference as a clip on somebody's ear, which, as you probably know from your occupational health and safety work with electricity, is a high impedance path to anywhere in the body, and it's high enough to actually upset the reading. So biologists are probably not getting the right values. One of the reasons why medical people tend to do that sort of thing is when you start playing around with any sort of voltages in the cells themselves or in vitro, you tend to have ionic solutions, which are very low impedance, and even microamp currents and microvolt currents can stop the heart or damage the brain or other vessels. So it's not something that medicos like playing with because of the potential risks to the patients. And that's why a lot of this work is actually done on animals, not on real on people. And perhaps it's why they're a little bit more circumspect about how they go about measuring some of these things. It takes an engineer to look at that. So, okay, where are we? We've got our inner hair cells and we've got our outer hair cells, and they are doing different things. The inner hair cells are actually working on the loudness. The broadband signal, how loud is it? The outer hair cells are frequency-dependent spectrum that have both spectral information and loudness information associated with them. But that's not enough. We feed them into this neural network that has an input amplifier called an Activa, and then it goes into a distribution amplifier that spreads it out into the neural net. And then the neural net does a whole lot of feature extraction and processing in exactly the same way as the retina does feature extraction in the eye. When you see something in the eye, it presents a picture on the surface of the retina, but that's not what gets fed down the optic nerve. What gets fed down the optic nerve is there's a straight line there, and a horizontal line, and a vertical line, and a cross line, and black and white, and those sorts of bits of information that your brain then integrates into a picture. The same feature extraction is happening in the sounds. So you hear transient sounds very easily. You don't hear regular sounds, long-term steady-state sounds as well. Why? Because there's no survival value in that. And this accounts with what I've been teaching to students in sound recording for 30 years about the difference in the way you perceive different types of sounds under different circumstances. It is because of the feature extraction at this next level, and it's analog, that a whole lot of the information is being extracted from the sounds that you're actually hearing and then translated into something that the brain then goes away and interprets. And once it gets into the ganglion cells on the nerve, in the audio nerve, it's then feeding into the brain and it goes into different areas of the brain, which he also goes into in great detail, but that actually matches some of their PET scan and MRI type information that's currently available, and you can even see it on television. Going to the analog to pulse, I said analog to digital. He said no, it's not digital, it's pulse, it's not ones and zeros, but it's he calls it phasic, but apparently that's the language that the biologists use. He said it's more akin to pulse generation in FM, where you have a signal that's there and you get a pulse generator. The more signal, you get more frequently pulses, okay, from one ganglion cell. But then it's you're getting those same signals from feature extraction engines and a large number of them, a large number of channels. So it's not just the frequency of distribution on a particular nerve, it's the number of nerves that have the density of sound on them that gives you the information that the brain actually processes. So it's much more complicated than saying there's a sound here, it's going to appear as a sound on one of these nerves. It's a feature that's going to produce a particular density of sound somewhere on the nerve system. You don't necessarily know where that is because it's genetically determined. So there's a whole lot of work to do about that analog to digital conversion, analog to pulse conversion at the interface between the ganglion cells and the analog neural network that's doing the feature extraction. Nearly finished. Two more slides. The mechanisms for this analog to digital conversion are still relatively unclear, but they seem to be consistent with the information I've seen on ordinary television programs about putting sounds into people's heads while they're inside a PET machine and looking at the bits of the brain that light up. That information seems to be totally consistent with this model. So I'm not an expert in that field, but I don't see anything that would give me reason to question that model. So what have we got? We've got that the basilar membrane itself is probably not the frequency selective membrane that we thought it was, and it's not the vibration of sound in the fluids that is a mechanism of transmission through the cochlea. It is instead a biological analog amplifier, amplifying the output from a waveguide, an audio waveguide, surface acoustic wave waveguide, that uses Snell's law to do frequency selection via a dispersive filter mechanism, which gives you and accounts for all of the sharp resonant effects without a tuned circuit inside. The mathematics for that particular function have been designed at Bell Labs in conjunction with optical fibre technology and optical fibre spectrum analysis, and it's called a Marcatelli filter, after Marcatelli, who found it. And yes, he is on Bell Labs, and you can read papers on that. I've read the abstracts. There's a whole lot of work that refers back to that in terms of frequency selectivity and dispersive filters. Analog to phasic or pulse conversion at the ganglion cells is via a signal-dependent one-shot oscillator. That's the ganglion cell itself, which is basically the capacitors at either end of the transistor charging and discharging. And they discharge into the transistor, you get an output loading into the next stage, and it resets and waits for the next bit of energy to charge up until it discharges. And it's a relaxation oscillator type mechanism. Again, it's something that I haven't been able to model with silicon, because you need two transistors to do it in silicon, but it does make sense that you could do it with one if you follow the logic of this explanation through. The intensity is the representation of the signal, the intensity of the signals on the nerve, but they don't represent the signals that you're hearing directly. They represent features that have been extracted by this analog neural net at the third layer of cells in from the hair cell. Where do you find more information on it? The key site is neuronresearch.net, the third one on the list, and that has links to both the hearing, which is the top one on the list, which has an alias, that's the second one on the list, but it also has links to the neuron and to the vision information. To understand this material, you have to read all of it. You have to read through the dense stuff, because he spends a lot of time actually saying, here's what this person said, that person said, this person said back to the 1880s. And here's how the field developed. Here's how the key papers were seminal. Here's what's wrong with them. And then here's how you can do what they've said they're looking for in a different way. I used to tell my students when they were reading Cherry, I used to try to get them to read it, I said, you sort of start at the beginning of the chapter and you see three-dimensional partial equations and you go run away in fright, or you can turn to the end of the chapter and read the last three paragraphs, which basically sum up everything you said beforehand, and you can take it for granted that the mathematics in the previous chapter actually works. I think there's an element of that sort of level of reading that you have to go on with this, because this guy is covering so many different fields, from biology to optics to neural biochemistry to electronics to solid-state devices. It's multidisciplinary like I've never seen before. And to jump from one discipline to the other and backwards and forwards between them to get the answers is, to say the least, quite challenging. And I guess if there's going to be challenge to come out of what I've presented tonight, it will be because it is so challenging and novel, in a way, that I'm presenting. There's also a book that he's written on hearing. It's available from Fulton directly online. I'm not sure how much it is. It's just a summary. It's compacted, but a little bit, 10% from the stuff that's online. It's a published book that is in the process of getting ISBN certification and those sorts of things. I guess what I'm now asking you to do is to challenge what I've presented. And if you know something about the area, please tell me I'm wrong or I'm right. That's what I'm asking for.
Are you asking now?
Yep. But I will.
Here's a question. We haven't listened to you. I'm trying to absorb and digest what you're saying, which was very clear by the way you listened.
Thank you.
The thing which bothers me, and I guess what you're saying, is that it's a model and not the territory.
Yep.
So what Fulton's model proposed and what you've tried to model electronically, all because a model exists, doesn't mean it has to be exactly like he says it is. So
exactly right.
What he's saying is that there's some sort of a transistor mechanism inside the cell,
mm-hmm.
and that's what the model is, but
yep.
it doesn't have to be a transistor mechanism inside the cell.
Yep. Graham, do you have a comment on that? Because you've got another model.
Well, he didn't present the field effect transistor yet.
No. Next year. Yeah, look, there is a single source at the moment. And all, if you do a Google search on this stuff, all searches point back to this Fulton research.
So here's the question for you. If the model works, if you can build it in silicon, how would that help anyone doing
anything
in the real world?
The example that Fulton gave me in about 2005 was, without giving anything away, the satellite optics for Earth Resources satellites and NASA satellites, Hughes satellites. He said that the sensors, the semiconductor sensors behind the optics in those, were modelled on the frog's eye. So there was a real-world application of understanding how an eye worked, admittedly a simple one, but he was able to use that as the basis for building a real-world camera that now you think nothing of looking at Google Earth pictures every day of the week. It's based on that direct application of the theory that he used from the vision stuff. And that's, in fact, how I found him, because I was looking at how the eye worked and I was coming up with nonsense that was unsubstantiated, and his theories on how the optical receptors work was the only one that was basically very reasonable. So yes, there are real-world examples. Has he done it in the year? I don't know. I haven't.
So I guess what you're saying is that you can process the sound in a certain way, but you can produce certain effects.
There are examples for where this theory is at the moment. Galileo hypothesized that the Earth was round. He had reasonable grounds for hypothesizing it because when he stood on the top of his tower and watched ships going out to sea, they disappeared and the mast was left standing and he could see them disappearing over the curvature of the Earth.
He could also see the moon, which was round.
And he could see the moon that was round. So he hypothesized that the Earth was round. At the time, the common wisdom was the Earth was flat. And Galileo was locked up in religious seclusion because he dared to challenge the acceptable wisdom. Another similar example was Einstein's theories of relativity suggested the property of time dilation. Nobody had observed time dilation. Time was a constant. But Einstein said, no, it's a variable. It wasn't until long after he died, and I think in the 1960s or 70s, that they took jet aeroplanes up into the stratosphere and flew atomic clocks in different directions. When they landed, they were at different times and different from the third one that they had on the Earth. So they had effectively proved time dilation. So this theory at the moment is in that stage where it's a hypothesis. There is data coming out that sort of tends to support it. Some of it makes logical sense. Some of it doesn't make any sense at all unless you understand how biological systems work, and I don't claim any knowledge in that area at all. All we can say is that there's a theory here and it seems plausible.
I'm taking away two notions from this. One is the challenge to the idea of how the concrete is working as a filter.
Yep.
Okay, but that I can find, you know, also quite well, sort of an intuitive feel for the physics involved.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, which the other part of this is this analog feature selection. Do you know to what extent that feature selection is acceptable with the traditional model?
Bits of it are it's not new. The activa is new, how the signals are amplified. The feature extraction is not new. For many years, opticians have been doing testing on the eyes, colorblind. Things like looking at vertical lines and horizontal lines and looking at the brain patterns in a PET scan. Well, it's the same mechanism. What Fulton is saying is that the neural mechanism, we're a biological entity, we're using the same mechanism for both.
But did anyone just follow the traditional notions except it was feature extraction?
I don't know if anyone has done it in quite the same way, but I know there is work heading in that direction. And I have seen discussions, as crudely as on television, that talk about this feature extraction to some limited extent. Now, whether it's directly supportive, I don't know. But it seems to be evidence in the direction that supports this rather than knocks it. And the evidence from the eye, it strongly supports it.
Comment. There's quite a bit of work on extracting precedence of hearing paths, other aspects of hearing, how you latch on to the other's arrival and try and form an object. And that work has been going on since the 40s and 50s.
And is it also simple that feature extraction is occurring before it actually gets to the brain?
There's quite a lot of work on an area of the brain called the pre-associative score, where all the ego goes in there, and if you don't draw down on that, your cognitive processes evaporates. Quite a bit of work on that, and that work was around about, say, 1968, 1969. My summary comment would be, it's 2011, do we really understand how the cochlear works? If we do, great, but we're getting conflicting stories and conflicting evidence. If we don't, there's an opportunity for everyone to come up with an alternative model and run past the evidence. Come on.
That's true. Absolutely true. And the one, if I've got a criticism, I've got a couple of criticisms of this work. One is that it's too detailed, and for a layperson, it's very difficult to keep track of all the bits and pieces. And it's not organised as an academic thesis perhaps would be organised. So you're looking at threads that are multiple parallel threads, and they sometimes come together and sometimes they come apart. That makes it difficult to follow. Secondly, it is a meta-analysis. It is not an empirical study. And I haven't been able to find sound empirical studies that confirm or refute very much of it. And that's the next stage.
It's so hard to study it.
Well, it's hard to study it. It's also not the traditional wisdom. So if you're in an academic environment and you've got a research supervisor who's saying, well, here's what the textbooks say, go and study that, you're already walking in with a preconception about how the system works. And that's the way academic research works. You know, you do a literature review first, and you don't stray too far from the literature. And that's one of the things I noticed with the paper that you sent me on the research of sounds in the cells and how the hair cell works. They've done some measurements. They've done some empirical studies. The first thing that they said is they've used the traditional model as their framework. So they've started with the preconception that the traditional model applies, now let's measure the voltages. Well, they've come up with a set of voltages that is equally consistent with this.
There does seem to be this one common factor that's drawn in these models, and that is that the hair cells are a bunch of frequency selective.
No, they're not. The hair cells themselves are not frequency selective. They're broadband. That's the difference.
But they're frequency selective by virtue of their placement.
Yes, it's the dispersive filter on Henson strut that is the frequency selective element.
Which is why the cochlear implant works whichever model you have.
Absolutely. Because it's providing electrical signals capacitively coupled in the right spot to be able to interpret it correctly.
I've got a question that sort of perhaps is pulling a little bit out of this, because it's well beyond an area by that much area.
Join the club.
I'm just wondering, as we age, we lose high-frequency response. Is there something within this model that might explain why that occurs?
Indeed, because one of the things that I haven't touched on that is later in the book is the medical applications of this in terms of pathologies. And this actually accounts for some of that high-frequency deficiency. The most obvious comment is, most of the energy is being delivered to the start of the at the launcher end, which is the high frequency end. So that's the bit that's going to get bombarded with high frequency, high energy right from day one. And that's going to deteriorate before the low energy, low frequencies are going to get right around the end 6 milliseconds later, where all the damaging stuff's been stripped out of it and there's only a little bit left to get to the hair cells. Quite apart from the calcification that applies and a few other biochemical things that also affect that. It's not just the damage that happens to the hair cells because
of this model, the hair cells potentially are identical all the way through. Mm. There's no
difference. They are.
Between the hair cells at the beginning and the hair cells at the end. So the hair cells themselves aren't deteriorating for any particular characteristic.
Well, they are. That's another mechanism. It's, you know, you get a heart attack, and it can be because the muscles of the heart die, or it could be the blood vessels to them. In this case, there are factors like calcification. If you get biochemical imbalances in the ear, then the chemistry around the cell itself could fail and cause failure of the cell. That happens increasingly with age. It's the natural death mechanism of cells in the body. And that is also a factor that's sort of in there, muddying the waters.
But that may be consistent across all of the cells.
One would expect so. One would expect so, but you notice elderly people get slowly, progressively deafer at the high frequencies, but also very low frequencies sometimes. But most elderly people I've experienced with hearing deficiency, most of the hearing deficiencies, the high frequencies disappear and they're left with low frequency mumble, very loud low frequency mumble.
Does the traditional model differentiate two lots of hair cells or one lot of...
It says there are two sets of hair cells, but it doesn't differentiate the function as far as I'm aware. Can you answer?
There's a model for the outer and inner hair cells. The current model is the outer hair cells and base fast, I suppose you call it muscle structure, can amplify. That's different to this.
I'm saying that mechanism's not observable.
One of the papers I sent you covered the Preston protein in that cell.
That's the one that gave the signals.
To change the morphology of the cell from 1 to 2 microseconds when the stimulus comes in. Where that is.
And what effect
it has. It's been discussed. Is it at the top of the hair cell, in the middle of the hair cell, or in the cell?
And when they break the hair cell open, it doesn't work.
No.
So, you know, they've actually raised more questions than they have answers. But the measurements that they did associated with that about the presence or absence of signals very clearly demonstrate the 600 hertz bandwidth of the channel filter. So, yes, there is evidence to support it, but it's little bits and pieces all over the place, yes.
So there's an observable phenomenon that if I listen to, say, somebody I know on the phone, I know that my telephone's not producing anything like that.
Yep.
There's a mechanism that fills the
frequency. Yep.
It's
nothing to do with the ear, that's all in the brain.
That's not in the ear.
It's not in the ear, it's all in the brain.
Because the traditional method one I was taught, and I think Grover talks about this in the video, he says that he thinks there's something in the basement membrane where
there's
some physical.
No. It can't exist because the basement membrane is so rigid. There is another mechanism that does happen in the ear, and bass guitarists should know this. When you distort a bass signal, actually the unamplified low octave on a bass guitar is virtually inaudible, but as soon as you distort it, the second harmonic becomes audible because it's the second harmonic, not the first, the fundamental. You put the fundamental back in, and that process happens in the brain. Now, if you get loud enough sound, that same distortion mechanism can happen in the ear as well. So just the presence of loud sounds will give you that doubling effect in the ear. But the sort of effect that you're talking about at moderate listening levels happens in the brain.
So there's also talk about the neurological processes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's another lecture. I only had 90 minutes tonight. But yes, he does go in three of his works into how the brain processes this and which parts of the brain process it, and that's all backed up with PET scan and so forth.
There is some interesting work. Oh, sorry.
Two things I'm having trouble coming to terms with. One is the analog to digital conversion. The rest of the body is analog, so why suddenly change to digital? What's wrong with that being still being analog?
Because the rest of the body isn't digital. 10% of it is. 10% of the body is digital, and it's the nervous system.
Yeah.
So once it gets into the nervous system, it's digital.
Okay.
Well, pulse or phasing.
All right.
Different words, but it's essentially what we know as digital.
And the other one is your waveguide theory, where the high frequencies come first, and they pull it out, and the smaller frequencies and go up the top of it. Where the waveguide theory is the opposite. The smaller the waveguide, the higher the frequency. So why aren't the low frequencies first?
The size of the waveguide isn't affected. It's the curvature of the waveguide. That's Snell's law.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I haven't studied that.
It's a prism. You've got a curved waveguide.
Yep.
The higher frequencies reach the critical angle first.
Right.
So they come out first.
Okay.
Physics. If your hearing loss is because of mechanical damage to the outer eardrum or the sapes, the ossicles, the cochlea is still functioning. Therefore, if you can get sound into the cochlea by injecting it through the bone, then the cochlea is going to work and the nerve impulses are going to be processed.
But does that depend on the source of the direction of sound vibration, or can it be from the other side of the cochlea?
As long as you can get sound into the cochlea, if you've got two of them, you'll get binaural hearing. How effective that is depends on how far the damage goes and where it is. But there's nothing in this theory that says bone conduction won't work as long as the cochlea works. And it may be a way of overcoming mechanical deficits.
Regarding optic bands, is there any explanation which helps
you
explain why?
No, because we... How can I explain this? Musicians are trained to hear octaves. We don't necessarily hear them naturally. Some things sound pleasant, some things don't sound pleasant. If you get used to it, I think Beethoven was thought to be absolutely non-musical because he used intervals that weren't harmonically related in the way that the first and third and fifth are. He used seconds and sevenths and whatever. But we like Beethoven now. So we can become accustomed to that sort of musical tempering. There's no mechanism to provide absolute pitch, although we know some people have it. And we also know that masking effects happen. So we can look at a loud sound and look at the envelope of sounds around that. And we can account for that by the dispersive filter again, or by the mechanical filter, if it's a resonance filter, simply by the shape of the filter detection curve. And there are a set of masking curves that break the sound spectrum up into, what is it, fonts? No, I'm thinking back about 20 years now to a textbook, but there is a way of actually measuring these sort of overlapping filters. And it's used in the work that Dolby did for subjective masking in Dolby and AC3 and all those sorts of things. But there's nothing in here that contradicts any of that.
One last question, maybe we'll break. Is there any sense of the source of tinnitus?
Yeah. The fact that the hair cells don't work doesn't stop the rest of the nervous system working. So if the actual transducer fails, the nervous system just generates random impulses. And you start interpreting those as sounds. And it's basically the sound of your nervous system working, and that's been known for at least 50 years that I'm aware of. So people with complete hearing loss still hear sounds.
Please join me in thanking Rod for a fascinating presentation.